other parks of the city, the treasured relics of generations here. He is only to hold office for a brief term. He is the passing creature of a day. He will in time, and that not long, be superseded. He may not waste the heritage of New York. In the meantime, he must restrain his extravagant, excessive energy and zeal, or he must be restrained. He issued the injunction. But Moses wasn't worried. He knew what was in the law. "I think the higher court will take care of Justice Carew," he told a reporter airily. And he was right. When Chandler appealed Carew's decision to the appellate division in Albany, the five justices of that court, sitting together in their high-backed chairs, said that the powers the legislature had granted to Moses were far too broad and indicated that they wished the legislature would revoke some of them. But for the present, they said, the law was passed, and it was unfortunately clear. They had no choice but to overrule Carew's decision. If Moses had the power to destroy the casino, Carew had said, he had the power to destroy the obelisk, the arsenal, city hall, or any other structure, no matter how historic, no matter how beautiful, no matter how treasured, in any park in New York City. Carew was wrong about City Hall. It lies just outside the northern boundary of City Hall Park. Moses couldn't tear it down. But Carew was right about everything else. Moving quickly to forestall any further appeals, Moses had crews of workmen tearing down the casino within 24 hours after he received a copy of the appellate court decision. Within 2 months, the building was gone and its site was covered with a playground. Except for its stained glass windows, which were used in the new police station being constructed on the 86th Street Transverse Road, Robert Moses had succeeded in eradicating every trace of the spiritual home of the man who had publicly humiliated Alfred E. Smith. This is Robertson Dean. We hope you have enjoyed The Power Broker, Robert Moses and the Fall of New York, by Robert Caro, Volume 1. This program was produced by Dan Musselman. Text copyright 1974, Robert A. Caro, Inc. Production copyright 2011, Random House, Inc. All rights reserved.
This audiobook has been broken into multiple parts to make the download faster. You have reached the end of a part, but not the end of the complete audiobook. So please check your library for the next part of this audiobook.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.
This is Audible.
Random House Audio presents The Power Broker, Robert Moses and the Fall of New York, by Robert A. Caro, Volume 2. Read for you by Robertson Dean. Chapter 21. The Candidate. There had been a day in 1934 on which the cheering had stopped. It was the day Robert Moses started running for governor. Moses was later to maintain that he had not wanted to run. "The Republican nomination was more or less forced on me," he was to say. He had accepted it only to hold the party together. Such loyalty to the grand old party is difficult to reconcile with the fact that Moses had spent 10 years of his life, the decade during which he worked for Al Smith, fighting it. Such loyalty is difficult to reconcile with the fact that in 1928, when Moses had believed he had a chance to win the Democratic gubernatorial nomination, he had enrolled as a Democrat. He had not re-enrolled as a Republican until 1933, when he needed GOP support for the fusion mayoral nomination. And in fact, no reconciliation is necessary. For if Moses' description of his attitude is based on his memory played him false. "No forcing was necessary at all," says F. Truby Davison, who first offered him the nomination. "I had a talk with Bob and asked him if he'd be willing to go. He didn't say yes, but he encouraged me." Says another source, "Bob told me Truby had offered him the nomination, and he asked my advice. My advice was not to take it, but I could see he was going to take it no matter what I said. He was hungry for it." The identity of the man who offered Moses the nomination is perhaps the clearest proof of the inaccuracy of the portrait Moses had painted of himself as the foe of the forces of influence, privilege, and wealth. For Truby Davison was the acknowledged representative of those forces. Son of J.P. Morgan's late partner, Henry P. Davison, heir to Henry P.'s estate, which, behind massive iron gates and thick walls of stone, occupied all 4,000 acres of Long Island's Peacock Point. No longer the naive young assemblyman who a decade earlier had been tricked by Moses into introducing the bills giving the Long Island Park Commission the right of condemnation by appropriation, Davison was a key figure in the ranks of the Long Island robber barons. And Davison was taking an active interest in the selection of the gubernatorial nominee, precisely because the barons felt that their influence and privilege, and to some extent, their wealth, were threatened. The barons, together with the upstate gas and water power utility interests, had dominated the state's Republican Party from time immemorial. To a large extent, in fact, the GOP was the barons and the interests. A fact made clear when H. Edmund Mockold, stepping down as Assembly Speaker in 1925, became, simultaneously, state GOP chairman and president of the gigantic utility holding company Niagara Hudson, and by the fact that among the downstate GOP congressmen were Robert Low Bacon, stipendiary of the House of Morgan, Ogden Livingston Mills, son of Darius Ogden Mills of the San Francisco bank ring, and willowy millionairess Ruth Baker Pratt, widow of one of the six sons for whom Rockefeller partner Charles Pratt had built manor houses on the Glen Cove Peninsula. It was important to the interests that they control the state GOP. It was important for business reasons. The party was the interests' traditional protector in Albany, and it was important for reasons that went beyond business. The conservatism of these men of property, to whom property rights were sacred, was not only financial but ideological, and they viewed their party as a bulwark against heresy, against the increasing emphasis on human as opposed to property rights that characterized the philosophy of the three Democrats, Smith, Roosevelt, and Lehman, who had usurped the executive chamber. Public reverence for their beliefs might be dying, but they would never surrender them. Not for nothing had journalists dubbed them the old guard. From the standpoint of both philosophy and pocketbook, in 1934, control of the state GOP was more important to the old guard than ever. Their fury at the New Deal, the purpose of the Roosevelt administration is the imposition of a Russianized form of government, snarled upstater Bertrand H. Snell, House Minority Leader, had led them to resolve that the presidential election of 1936 would be a holy crusade to oust that man from the White House, and they intended to make New York, with its 45 electoral votes, the crusade's embarkation point. Moreover, most of the old guard, anybody who amounted to anything in the GOP, Warren Moscow said, owned Niagara Hudson stock, whose value would be immensely increased by the finalization of the scheme that had been the party's grail for almost four decades. The turning over to private utilities, such as Niagara Hudson, of the immense water power resources of the St. Lawrence and Niagara Rivers. Smith had established a state power authority to keep those resources in the hands of the state's people. Roosevelt had pointed out dramatically that only two heartbeats, his and that of Lieutenant Governor Lehman, separated the power trust from the state's water power, and millions of New York families from higher monthly electric light bills. Lehman, as governor, had proved even more effective, undramatically but stubbornly shoving down the legislature's throat bills giving the State Public Service Commission authority over utility rates, forbidding the use of utility funds for political lobbying, and, in a step the utilities viewed as particularly ominous, allowing municipalities to construct their own plants and distribute power at low rates. Only the legislature stood between Lehman and still more radical anti-utilities measures he was proposing. It was vital to the old guard, more vital than ever, that the GOP control the legislature, and that they control the GOP. But control of the party had been snatched away from the old guard by the former amateur in politics they had once betrayed, but who had acquired from his bitter fight with Robert Moses a professionalism that made him their equal, W. Kingsland Macy. Macy had lost the Taylor estate fight, his first political battle. He had not lost another one. Having learned the hard way the importance of public opinion, he purchased a string of weekly newspapers that blanketed Suffolk County, and by 1927 had ousted the county GOP chairman, installed himself in his place, and purged the county organization with a ruthlessness so complete that his control of it would not be seriously challenged for a quarter of a century. Then he turned his attention to wider spheres. Before the barons quite realized what was happening, he had seized the Republican state chairmanship. Once in power, Macy proved that pince nez, starched high round collars and blue suits with vests, the outfit he was to affect until he died in 1960, were no guarantee of conservatism. Attempting to reverse his party's blind obstructionism to progressive policies that had been largely responsible for the repeated victories of Smith, Roosevelt, and Lehman in a state in which voter registration was heavily Republican, Macy excoriated GOP legislators who opposed Roosevelt's attempt to blunt the effects of the Depression through increased spending, and embarrassed enough of them into supporting the state's Temporary Emergency Relief Administration to give the measure the votes it needed to pass. Dismissing the fear of the old guard leaders that, if they authorized an investigation of corruption in New York City, Roosevelt would authorize investigations of corruption upstate, Macy called GOP legislators into closed-door caucuses in Albany and, using every ounce of patronage at his command, broke the power of grim old William Ward and forced the tyrant of Westchester to release his legislators to vote as they wished, thereby allowing the passage of the bills initiating the Seabury investigation. And it was pressure from Macy that persuaded Republican fusionists to bow to Seabury's demand and, over old guard objections, give the nomination for mayor to the dangerous rabble-rouser LaGuardia. Astounded and antagonized by the course on which Macy was leading their party, the old guard was thrown into panic by his next announcement, pointing out, accurately, that the GOP's identification with the power trust was a political liability. Macy proposed to end the trust's domination of the party by making Seabury, who had long attacked utilities as monopolists and exploiters of the people, its next gubernatorial nominee.
"Well, that was all we had to hear," Truby Davison would growl 3 decades later, sitting with one gouty leg propped on a footstool in the 30-foot-high study of his mansion on Peacock Point, topping off with Cherry's Jubilee a light lunch served by a white-coated butler and staring out across the Davison compound's half-mile-long terraced croquet court.
"Seabury was a Democrat, for one thing. That was enough. And he was full of this honesty in government thing that was so teeing these guys, Davison's old guard colleagues, off. He was calling everybody crooks, just like Macy."
The old guard hastily began looking for a candidate of its own to run against the implacable old idealist. The qualifications required, in addition to respect for the sanctity of holding companies, were quite explicit. What was needed, said an old guard-sponsored magazine, was a candidate who symbolizes the spirit of uncompromising, courageous opposition to the whole Roosevelt socialistic program. There was a catch, however. While the old guard was determined to have a candidate who shared its views, 1934 was no year to have a candidate who was publicly identified with those views. What was wanted, in short, was a candidate who was actually a reactionary conservative, but who the public believed was a radical liberal. What was wanted was a front man, someone whose reputation would give protective coloration to their attempt. They turned to Robert Moses. Moses may have antagonized them once, when he threatened to run the Northern State Parkway right past their manor houses, but in the intervening years, they had come to know him better. His aggressiveness had, after all, turned out to be not the hostility of the radical, idealistic reformer to property and power, but something quite the opposite, an expression of his regard for power, an acknowledgement of the fact
that he had on his side in the person of that uneducated, practically illiterate demagogue from the Fulton Fish Market, the one man in the state with power equal to theirs, and therefore did not have to compromise with them. As soon as he no longer had this power behind him, he had changed, suddenly, dramatically, and to them, satisfyingly. He had proven understanding, sympathetic in fact, to their desire to keep the rabble away from their estates. He had proven his sympathy, in their view, by his agreement to make the parkway not an access way to parks on the North Shore, but a traffic bridge, a chute similar in principle to a cattle chute, on which the public would be shunted across the Gold Coast without being allowed to get off and contaminate it. His receptivity to their demands for private parkway entrances and bridges had proven him to be what they called a practical man, a man willing to make accommodation with power. His deal with Otto Kahn had been further testimony to this. After all, a man who would turn a highway aside to save a private golf course couldn't be all bad, as had his relationship with the politician who most directly represented them in state affairs. J. Russell Sprague, G. Wilbur Doughty's nephew, had succeeded the last of the Mohicans as head of the Nassau County Republican organization, and by 1934 had displayed all of his uncle's ability to obtain wampum for his braves. And Sprague told the barons that Moses was a man you can get along with. Moses had cemented his relationship with the barons by entertaining them in reserved portions of Jones Beach, and by displaying during dinner parties at their mansions a hatred for the president equal to theirs. Reported the North Shore Almanac, a weekly newspaper that echoed the political views of the Gold Coast, he is not a New Deal radical. He doesn't believe that the New Deal is working or can work. Finally, his friends say that he doesn't like Mr. Roosevelt at all. Moses' view of the people, they found, was in fact as strikingly similar to theirs as was his view of the people's president. Just as important to the old guard as this facet of Moses' personality was the fact that the public didn't know about it. Thanks to his genius for public relations, to the people, he was still the fighter for parks and against privilege. And therefore, if he was the old guard candidate against Seabury, the press would not be able to charge that the old guard and the scandal-scarred utilities were trying to keep control of the GOP. No one would believe Macy if he charged that Robert Moses was a front for the power lobby. Asked 3 decades later why he had wanted Moses to run, Davison would admit to the author, "No one questioned Moses' honesty. Macy had been calling everybody crooks, and he certainly couldn't say this about Moses. My thought was, if we could get somebody like Moses, they couldn't say that." There were still some obstacles between Moses and the nomination. A number of Republican leaders simply couldn't stomach the thought of giving it to a man who had spent so many years humiliating them. But the old guard knew how to handle such scruples. Relentless economic pressure was applied. When the opposition had been whittled down to a few diehards, Davison called a Sunday afternoon meeting of the party leaders in the Fifth Avenue apartment of his mother, Mrs. Henry P. Davison. "Well, this meeting was just like an of thee I sing," Davison would recall. "It was the kind of thing you put on the stage. We had all the leaders there, but some of them, that fellow from Queens, Queens leader Warren Ashmead, and the Syracuse bunch, wanted to run out on us, and I had to tell them they had better come back, and they did, but I knew we had to get this thing wrapped up or the agreement would fall apart. I sent out to the Lynx Club for sandwiches, and I gave the elevator man $5 not to stop at our floor so nobody could go down, and we wrapped the thing up. Then I wanted Bob up there so the whole thing would be made final, and he was out fishing on the Great South Bay. We got the state police, and they got him off the Great South Bay and brought him to New York. Then Bob and Russ Sprague and I went down to the other end of the apartment to a bedroom, and we said, 'Now the fellows are willing to support you, and we've got the votes.' He said, 'Well, this is like swimming up Niagara Falls in a coonskin coat,' meaning this was a very hard election to win, but he agreed to accept the nomination." Davison's strategy worked. Moses' acceptance of the nomination made him the reactionary's ally, but most newspapers responded, as did the Buffalo Evening News, which said, "None can say that Robert Moses is a Tory. His every act since entering public life has been dedicated to the best interests of the many." Even Baron Warren of the Times could only express puzzlement at the alliance. "One of the odd turns of politics," he mused. Macy was robbed of the chance to portray the nomination struggle as one between an honest liberal and a candidate of the power trust. The battle at the GOP convention, held in Rochester in September, was bitter. "The convention will go down in history as one of the most hectic the GOP has ever held," commented the Rochester Times-Union. But the result was foreordained, and Moses' nomination was cheered by both press and public. "At last, an idealist in politics," said one typical letter to the editor. Under cover of the cheering, the state committee was able to meet immediately after the nomination and oust Macy as state chairman. The depth of the misunderstanding of Moses' philosophy was exemplified by an editorial in the World Telegram, noting that the platform adopted by the convention was an uncompromising denunciation of the New Deal. The World Telegram said, "Mr. Moses may be able to fit himself to such a platform. We doubt it. With the reputation and record Mr. Moses has as a liberal, we don't see how he can." The World Telegram didn't know that Moses had written much of the platform himself. If the press was puzzled by Moses' nomination, it was to be dumbfounded by his campaign. For Robert Moses as a candidate was a phenomenon of a type not seen very often on the American political scene. It seemed as if he was trying to set some kind of record for antagonizing people, Windels recalls. The time at Moses' disposal was limited. In keeping with the custom of the era, the campaign ran for only 5 weeks, but he didn't waste a day of it. The element of the GOP most enthusiastic about his nomination was the Young Republicans. The very evening after the convention, Davison hosted a cocktail party for them so that Moses could convert their enthusiasm into active support. But things didn't work out quite as Davison expected. "They got into this argument, and he started calling them names, and they started calling him names," Davison recalls. "My God! It ended up in a fearful row." Having thus rallied young Republicans to his standard, Moses turned his charm on their elders. Davison raised a massive war chest for the campaign, but he recalls, "Moses wouldn't consult with me. I must have been the most inactive campaign chairman in history as a result. Once the campaign started, we never saw him. He locked himself up in an ivory tower someplace, and we never saw his speeches until he gave them. And then he put Ray McNulty in our office, the state committee office, to keep an eye on us, I think. Well, didn't that just sit well with the boys?" With his own party taken care of, Moses turned to the opposition. The fact that he was running as a Republican and against Lehman meant that he had to forfeit the support of the men and women he had worked with in government. Most of them, veterans of the Smith, Roosevelt, and Lehman administrations, were Democrats. All of them were believers in increased government activity to promote social welfare, precisely the cause most hated by the old guard with which Moses had allied himself. Moses should not have expected their backing, but he did. And the way in which he asked for it, or rather demanded it, and his reaction when it was not forthcoming, were not particularly gracious. There were a succession of unpleasant endings to pleasant dinner parties at which Bob and Mary were guests. One occurred at the Manhattan townhouse of Aaron Rabinowitz. Rabinowitz, a fabulously successful realtor turned philanthropist, was Lehman's partner in the state's first limited dividend housing corporation, which the two men had formed, at a cost to each of them of about $375,000, in an attempt to attract private capital to low-income housing. "I was Moses' friend, too," Rabinowitz recalls. "We were very close, until one day he was at the house for dinner. He had just been nominated for governor." As the two men chatted outside the dining room after dessert, Moses asked,
You're going to help me become governor, aren't you?
Rabinowitz recalls, I said, I can't. I was Lehman's partner. I was a Democrat.
He turned and walked out without a word, and for 15 years, whenever we met, he wouldn't talk to me.
Henry Moskowitz, Bell's husband and Moses' old boss on the Municipal Civil Service Commission, traditionally handled the foreign language press for the Democratic Party. Now Moses asked Moskowitz to do the same job for him, the Republican candidate.
Henry said what I said. I can't, Rabinowitz recalls. Moses never talked to him again. He owed that man a lot, but the lousy no-good wouldn't even go to his funeral.
The friendship of Moses' old associates, men like Joseph Proskauer and Bernard Scheintag, might have kept them from taking an active role in the campaign. But after one visit apiece from Moses, all of them were out working for, and lending their powerful names to, Lehman's re-election bid, and thereby emphasizing that Moses was opposing the liberal causes with which he had so long been identified. Then there was the press. Most candidates attempt to woo reporters covering the campaign. It took Moses exactly one press conference to turn them icily frigid toward his candidacy. This might have been surprising to those who had observed his long love affair with the press, but that love affair had endured only because he had never been exposed to the probing questioning to which reporters subject most public officials. His aides, who knew his sensitivity to even the most discreetly implied criticism, could have predicted what would happen when he was. Moses entered his first press conference smiling broadly and clasping the hands of old acquaintances in the press corps as he strode into the room. But practically the first question asked was the natural one, considering the confusion over how a liberal could be nominated by the most conservative elements of the Republican Party. Mr. Moses, are you a protege of the old guard? Said the World Telegram that afternoon. The gubernatorial candidate drew his breath sharply, and there was a glitter in his eyes. Jumping to his feet, jabbing his finger at the reporter who had asked the question, he heatedly declared, "Nobody has any strings on me," and demanded, "Have you asked the same question of Governor Lehman? Did you ask him if he is a protege of Tammany Hall?" In what the World Telegram called a display of temper, he began lecturing the reporters on how to do their job, and then announced belligerently that he would not take lying down anything that was said against him by newspapers. Moses carried out this threat with a vengeance. By the end of the campaign, he was spending a substantial part of his press conferences berating the press, and he had completely forfeited the sympathy with which most reporters had been prepared to view his candidacy. If there was a blunder that could be made, Moses made it. He wanted LaGuardia's support, and assumed he would have it. After all, he was a member of LaGuardia's administration, and the mayor was a Republican. So Moses told the press he had it, and announced a city hall meeting with LaGuardia, at which, he told reporters, the mayor would announce it. Unfortunately, Moses hadn't bothered to check with LaGuardia. The mayor had been under pressure from President Roosevelt, with whom he was negotiating for federal relief funds, to stay out of the gubernatorial campaign, but had indicated to Corporation Counsel Windels that he would campaign for Moses nonetheless. But Moses taking his support for granted infuriated him. After the City Hall meeting, which lasted almost an hour, LaGuardia said blandly, "He'd make a good governor. Gosh, yes." But refused to say he would make a better governor than Lehman, and he remained seated firmly on the sidelines throughout the campaign. Moses had quietly ducked out of City Hall while reporters were questioning the mayor, but they cornered him later at 80 Center Street, and he could do nothing but admit that, as the Sun put it, he did not expect Mayor LaGuardia to make any campaign speeches in his behalf, as the mayor probably would be too busy with city affairs. Moses chose a tour of the upstate Republican heartland, where voters were bitterly opposed to any increase in governmental spending or power, to advocate the imposition of a state sales tax. And he didn't make the suggestion in just any upstate city. He did it in Binghamton,
where the Chamber of Commerce had just finished collecting tens of thousands of names on anti-sales tax petitions. He chose Syracuse, center of Onondaga County farm country, as the place to attack Macy, a hero to farmers because of his battle against the utilities that forced them to pay exorbitant rates for hookups to power lines. Then Moses moved on to Rochester. Reported the World Telegram, upstate audiences were surprised by the advocacy by Mr. Moses of a sales tax and startled when he struck at Mr. Macy, but they were left speechless last night at Convention Hall in Rochester when he casually gave his opinion that Herbert Hoover, still technically the party's national leader, failed to realize the need for action in fighting the Depression and had lost his strength of war days. As Moses moved on to Buffalo, fifth city on his itinerary, the World Telegram reported that he left behind him a trail of bewildered and frightened party leaders. In 4 days, the upstate leaders say, he has alienated 4 large blocks of Republican voters. Senate Majority Leader George R. Fearon of Syracuse had warned Davison not to nominate Moses. "Don't do it," Fearon had said. "I know Moses." Now he told Davison, "Well, you've done it. Now we're going to lose the legislature." Truby scoffed. The Republicans hadn't done that since 1912. When he did deign to discuss campaign plans with the men who had expected to help plan his campaign, Moses was firm. There was going to be no eating of bagels in Jewish neighborhoods or of sausages in Italian while photographers clicked away, he told them. He was determined to eschew the sideshows, which were a traditional part of political campaigns in the state that possessed the largest collection of ethnic blocs in America. There was, of course, something admirable in this determination, just as there was something admirable in Moses' enunciation of controversial views before groups hostile to those views. Moses' refusal to take the culinary road to the State House could be interpreted as an indication that he was going to take the high road instead, that he was one candidate who would not pander to the people, but who would instead discuss important issues with them freely, frankly, and fully, and who would say what he believed, even if what he believed was that the state needed a sales tax. But such an interpretation turned out to be an inadequate explanation of Moses' campaign tactics. For the candidate, it turned out, was declining not only to pander to the people, but, as much as possible, even to talk to them. And while the road he took in the campaign may not have been the culinary, it was certainly not the high either. Because Moses was less well-known upstate than in and around New York City, his campaign managers suggested a heavier-than-usual crossroads campaign, the traditional gubernatorial candidate's automobile tour of upstate towns and villages. Moses replied that there wasn't going to be any crossroads campaign. He was not going to visit upstate towns and villages. He was not going to appear upstate at all, except in large cities, such as Buffalo, Rochester, and Syracuse. And even in the cities, there would be no cocktail receptions, no coffee and cake receptions, no walking tours of shopping districts, no attempts at all to meet the public. His only appearances would be formal speeches. Then he told his campaign managers that he was going to follow the same policy in and around New York City. His only public appearances anywhere would be for formal speeches. And there would not be many of them. When he finished cutting down the schedule of speeches they had planned, his campaign managers realized that he was going to appear in public exactly 12 times. With the exception of those 12 occasions, his only communication with the voters he wanted to elect him to office would come through press releases. And if the campaign managers were at first dejected at Moses' insistence on keeping the number of his speeches small, they were soon to count it as a blessing. For, as Windels put it, every time he opened his mouth, he lost 10,000 votes. Moses' first speech, delivered at the Kismet Temple, a huge auditorium in Brooklyn, after he was escorted to the podium by a steel-helmeted American Legion band and a cadre of the Old Guard, who had dined with him before the rally at their spiritual home, the Union League Club, started the campaign off on the wrong foot.
Moses had always been as much a fanatic on the subject of religion as his grandmother and mother. He had always insisted that he was not Jewish. He did everything he could to make his feelings clear. He sent his daughters to an Episcopalian school, made disparaging remarks about qualities he felt characterized Jews, and when he learned that the editors of the Jewish Encyclopedia were planning to include his biography in its pages, threatened to sue them for libel if they did. To a people that had suffered because of their religion, and that was suffering still, in 1934, thousands of New York Jews were agonizing over the fate of relatives trapped in Germany, Moses' attempt to deny it was contemptible. Jews who knew of his feelings regarded him with bitterness. Members of Temple Emmanuel, the congregation that included most of the leaders of the Jewish community, and therefore most of the men who were familiar with Moses' beliefs, laughed bitterly at the fact that he was seen at many funerals of Catholic Tammany politicians at St. Patrick's Cathedral, but almost never at funerals at Emmanuel. City Comptroller Joseph D. McGoldrick, discussing Moses with a group of Jewish leaders, was shocked at the intensity of their feelings. To them, McGoldrick says, he was a Jew who had renounced his religion, and that was worse than anything. He was an apostate to his faith. But not many Jews were privy to Moses' feelings. Because of his name, they simply assumed he was of their faith. Assumed it, that is, until his first speech, in which, apparently stung by a similar assumption by the press, he brought up the subject of religion himself, and brought it up in a way deeply offensive to Jews. Moses didn't say, "I'm a Jew and I'm proud of it," as he should have, recalls Paul Windels. Instead, he said, "It's nobody's business what my religion is," and that got a lot of people very angry. Soon, in shabby shuls in the Bronx, as well as at Temple Emmanuel, Robert Moses was being called by a term which comes close to being the ultimate insult among pious Jews. Moses, they said, was an apikoros, a man who says he isn't what he is. Succeeding speeches were worse. Moses insisted on beginning many of them with an attempt to dispose of a false issue that he maintained the press was raising. The fact that his candidacy was part of an attempt by the Power Trust, or Old Guard, to recapture control of the state. Actually, the press had scarcely mentioned the issue. It was Moses, unable to endure even a hint of criticism, who kept bringing it up. There were press conferences, at least in the early stages of the campaign, while he was still holding press conferences, at which he was the only person who mentioned the phrase "Old Guard." His method of issue disposal, moreover, was not particularly convincing. It consisted of flat assertions. He was not the Old Guard or Power Trust candidate, he said on one occasion. Neither one of these stuffed shirts has any place in my life or acquaintance. On another, he stated without qualification, I am a liberal. Not only were these assertions false, both before and after the election, Moses repeatedly declared without qualification, I am a conservative, but they sounded false, since Moses was of course unable to explain who had obtained him the nomination if it was not the Old Guard. His assertion that he would regulate utilities as strictly as Lehman had an equally hollow ring, since he did not offer a single specific regulatory proposal. The only result of Moses' insistence on disposing of the utilities issue was to keep it fresh in voters' minds, and to keep himself on the defensive about it. And Moses on the defensive was a more attractive sight than Moses on the attack. He had decided that the way to defeat Lehman was to destroy the governor's image. Unfortunately for this strategy, Lehman's case was that rarity, one in which the image was the man. The governor's intimates knew him as an individual somewhat less than brilliant, and aware he was less than brilliant, but determined to make up for this shortcoming by hard work and dedication, and ambitious not for himself. He had not even wanted to be governor, accepting the post only when Smith and Roosevelt, admiring his integrity and his dedication to liberal principles, insisted that he succeed them, but for the people. And the voters knew him the same way. After the campaign, Moses himself would say that Lehman was essentially a cautious, dependable citizen of the old school,
who carried on the work of Smith and Roosevelt without basic innovation, but who was enormously conscientious and hard-working. I would classify him as a distinguished governor. Herbert Lehman, Robert Moses would say after the campaign, was a man of fine character. Moses knew even better than most of Lehman's intimates that the only thing that mattered with Lehman was principle. It was Lehman who, running the state while Roosevelt was on vacation, had appointed Moses Moreland Commissioner to head a politically sensitive investigation into the bankrupt City Trust Company without bothering to clear it with the governor, because he thought Moses was the right man for the job. In a score of quarrels between Roosevelt and Moses, Lehman had stood up, quietly, nervously, but unshakably, for Moses, for no other reason than that he thought Moses was right. And Moses knew something that even most of Lehman's intimates didn't know, because Lehman never publicized it. He knew that Lehman, touched by the plight of the small depositors who had lost their savings in the city trust debacle, had donated $1 million of his own money in an attempt to save the bank. There were no points at which the image could be attacked, truthfully, and Moses knew it, as his statements after the campaign reveal. But this was not after the campaign. This was the campaign, a campaign in which, at least for Moses, the prize was power. And the voters were soon reading headlines that said, "Moses calls Lehman weak. Moses calls Lehman stupid. Moses calls Lehman puppet forced to speak for Tammany." And the headlines didn't exaggerate the viciousness of Moses' attacks. In the speech in which he called Lehman weak, he also said that the governor had no guts, and that he applies to every act the test of personal and political expediency. Puppet was one of the more polite terms that Moses employed in his accusations about Lehman and Tammany Hall. The governor is the respectable front for the Hall's crooked politicians, Moses said, the instrument of consolidating their power and furthering their ends. The governor, he said, is a miserable, sniveling type of man, contemptible. Repeatedly, Moses challenged Lehman to debate him. Moses was, after all, a past president of the Oxford Union. Just let him get slow, plodding Herbert Lehman on the platform, and he would tear him apart, he told aides. Lehman, advised by men who knew Moses well, Proskauer, Scheintag, and Moskowitz, for example, handled Moses just right. The governor ignored the invitation to debate, and, to a large extent, he ignored Moses' charges. In fact, to a large extent, he ignored Moses, sticking strictly to a discussion of the issues and his record, as he campaigned earnestly, 9 speeches in a single day, through the upstate towns and villages and the streets of New York City, in which Moses would not deign to appear. The governor mentioned Moses just 3 times in the first 3 weeks of the campaign, and every mention was devastating. In answer to Moses' charges that he was a puppet of Tammany Hall, the governor pointed out that he had left Moses in charge of the state park system and had increased his powers in other fields against the advice of Tammany leaders. Weak? He had fought for Moses' park policies against the Republican legislative leaders who were now backing Moses. The third time Lehman mentioned Moses was in a speech in Binghamton, whose householders paid monthly electric bills to the Associated Gas and Electric System, a utility which had recently been publicly disclosed to have paid State Senator Warren Thayer $21,600 to kill measures that might have lowered its rates. The Republican candidate for governor undertook to eliminate certain issues from this campaign, Lehman said mildly. He attempts to dispose of the public utility problem by claiming it was not an issue. Surely we can understand his desire to avoid the public utility issue. We can appreciate his anxiety to divert attention from the weakness of the record of his party. Unfortunately, however, candidates do not make issues. The people make the issues. It is the people themselves who determine those matters upon which they are entitled to honest report. No candidate can tell the people of the state of New York that it is not important to furnish electricity, gas, and telephone service to consumers at low rates. Newspapers throughout the state agreed. Even the Brooklyn Eagle, whose editor, Cleveland Rogers, was one of Moses' most enthusiastic admirers, had to admit, he cannot dispose of the so-called power issue by oversimplifying it, as he tried to do. Moses' response was to increase the violence of his attacks and the wildness of his accusations. He accused Lehman of being responsible for corruption in the Court of Claims, an accusation which ignored the fact that the court was not under the governor's control and which was not strengthened by the fact that to document the court's incompetence, Moses accused of drunkenness a judge who actually had been dead for more than a year. He accused Lehman of discussing the city trust report with him in advance of its publication in 1929 because he was anxious to avoid an extension of the investigation, a charge that Moses later admitted in private was not true. Some of his charges had no logic at all. He said flatly that Lehman created most of the state deficit, although, as Moses well knew and the press pointed out, when Lehman took office, the deficit had been $114 million, and the governor had since reduced it practically to zero. He implied that Lehman had made an alliance with the O'Connell brothers, Dan and Ed, the Democratic bosses of Albany, because he was afraid of them. Not only afraid in political terms, but physically afraid, because the governor of the state of New York was worried that the two O'Connell boys might beat him up. Incredible as the statement was, there is no other way to interpret Moses' exact words. He wants O'Connell votes, and he is physically afraid of crossing or antagonizing people who, if they have nothing else, have boldness and physical courage. Even the governor's financial integrity was not safe from Moses' tongue and pen. In the campaign's most astonishing charge, he startled dozing reporters at a sleepy Republican women's club luncheon in Syracuse by accusing Lehman, who had done more to break the utility's power than any governor in the state's history, of being the utility's secret ally. Waving a sheaf of papers that he claimed documented his charges, Moses stated flatly that the governor had financial ties with the utility field. And, as the reporters goggled with amazement, he added that the corrupt Senator Thayer is a very small factor in public utilities in New York state politics. Why, Governor Lehman is much more a factor than Thayer ever thought of being. When Moses' documentation was examined closely, the ties he mentioned with such sinister implication turned out to be nothing more than the underwriting of a utility company bond issue, underwriting that had not even been done by Herbert Lehman, but by Lehman Brothers, the family banking firm in which Herbert Lehman had never played much of a role, and from which he had severed every tie years before. Such scrupulousness was by no means common among public officials of the day, but, as Lehman biographer Alan Nevins put it, he was scrupulous about everything. If some decision of his might affect a company in which he owned stock, he whipped off a sale of the stock. During Lehman's long public career, there had never been, and never would be again, even the faintest hint of impropriety. But Moses did not let these facts deter him, nor did he let deter him the fact that, hard as he tried, he could not find a single direct link in Lehman's life with any utility company. Lehman's banker brothers had such links, so Moses talked about the brothers. Robert Lehman is on the board of directors of the American International Corporation. Arthur Lehman is a director in the American International, a holding company, really. A surprising list of utilities, stocks, and bonds. 77,000 Columbia Gas and Electric, 50,000 American Electric Power and Light. There's a lot of this stuff. And then, attempting to establish the governor's guilt by association, said, "Now, I have got a lot of other stuff with me along these lines. There isn't time to read it, but it is a very interesting record, and I am going to refer to it at length to show you how false the governor is." It was on October 23rd that Moses really went too far. In a speech in Utica's Majestic Theater before 2,000 dairy farmers from the surrounding countryside, he called Lehman a liar. That was a word that was just never used then in campaigns for high office, Paul Windels recalls. Veteran political observers could not recall it ever having been used in a New York gubernatorial campaign.
and it really sent a wave of shock through everybody. People had been becoming quite angry at the things he was saying about Lehman. You had to know Lehman to understand why, and this was the last straw. Moses' use of the word was particularly indefensible. It came in the course of his attempt to link Lehman to inflated milk prices, despite the fact that the governor had no control over such prices. In the Utica speech, Moses told the audience of dairy farmers, angry over the fact that while the price of milk kept rising, the percentage of the price they received from the middleman dairy interests remained small, that Lehman was also responsible for that. The governor, he said, was linked to dairy interests, because, he said, Lehman Brothers had traded in the stock of companies interested in the milk business, and had simply lied to the people of the state when he claimed that he did not control the state milk control board, which set both milk prices and the percentage of those prices paid to farmers. That was a deliberate, cold-blooded evasion, Moses said. In fact, it was just a lie. He had the authority himself, but lacked the guts to exercise it. Moses' accusation was a lie. He said that Lehman controlled two members of the board, when in fact the governor controlled only one, the other two being Republicans removable only by the legislature. But when Lehman pointed this out, Moses' only answer was to repeat the charge the next evening, saying, "I said that Governor Lehman lied about the milk administration. He did lie about it." Lehman's advisors gathered in a hasty strategy conference to decide what to do about the insult. As it turned out, they didn't have to do a thing. Moses' own supporters did it for them. General John F. O'Ryan, the respected reformer, who, along with Moses, had been blackballed out of the 1933 fusion nomination for mayor by Seabury, had been backing Moses for governor. Now, the general announced that he wasn't backing Moses any longer. "Mr. Moses," he said, "has indicated by his own acts and words his unfitness for the office he seeks." Even the campaign manager for Moses' own running mate, GOP United States senatorial candidate E. Harold Cluett, publicly announced that he would not vote for the head of the GOP ticket. "He is not the type of man qualified for the leadership of the Republican Party," he said. Running mate McGoldrick, Republic and Fusion Party nominee for comptroller, kept silent publicly, but let anyone who asked privately know how he felt. "The thing was terrible," McGoldrick was to say later. "Those savage attacks on Lehman, personal stuff, just wouldn't wash." Upstate newspapers that for generations had supported every Republican candidate for statewide office announced that they couldn't support this one. Most New York City newspapers rushed into print with editorials like one in the World Telegram, which said, "Robert Moses, as was to be expected, has proved a far more aggressive and agile campaigner than the governor. But aggressiveness cannot in itself inspire confidence. Realities are realities, not to be concealed by curtains of words or by calling Governor Lehman weakling and liar." Moses' only response was to keep calling Lehman a liar, to flail out at the governor more savagely than ever, and to broaden the arc of his wild swings until he was attacking not only the governor's advisors, but men connected only peripherally or not at all with his administration. Within a matter of days, he had attained a novel and perhaps unique distinction. He was the first, and perhaps the only, candidate in the history of New York State on whom a radio network demanded non-stop libel insurance. The Mutual Broadcasting System refused to broadcast any of his speeches unless the Republican Campaign Committee purchased a policy that covered every word that Moses said on the air. Some of Moses' sallies were reminders of the brilliance of the political invective he had displayed in the LaGuardia mayoral campaign of 1933, when he himself had not been personally involved. Jim Farley, still bleeding from his dissection by Moses in the mayoral campaign, wandered into the gubernatorial contest with a quiet little statement of support for Lehman and promptly found himself back on Moses' operating table. Noting that Farley was president of a firm which supplied sand and other building materials to contractors, including some who received government contracts, as well as being postmaster general and chief patronage dispenser for the New Deal,
Moses dubbed him the sand, mail, and bag man of the National Administration, and then shortened the description to Jim Farley, the big bag man. But in most of Moses' attacks, brilliance was made the slave of rage. The scalpel was discarded in favor of the bludgeon, and the swings Moses took with the latter weapon were wild indeed. During its final 2 weeks, his campaign was almost entirely a campaign ad hominis, an exercise in wholesale insinuation and vituperation. Seeing his hopes for elective office vanishing, he spewed venom over his opponents, all his opponents, former friends as well as longtime foes, men who were motivated by principle as well as men motivated by politics. In speeches broadcast across the state by the libel-insured Mutual Network, Moses called Roosevelt's former law partner, Basil O'Connor, a fixer and a chiseler, Seabury a demagogue with a messianic complex, and the state's senior United States Senator, Dr. Royal S. Copeland, a former eye surgeon, a professional mountebank. The closest of former friends, men such as Joseph Proskauer and Morris S. Tremaine, state comptroller under Smith, Roosevelt, and Lehman, with whom Moses had worked closely for years, were not immune. Tremaine, he implied, was senile. "I like Morris Tremaine personally," he said. "He is an old chum of mine, but I think he is getting stale at Albany. Morris ought to get away from statistics for a while. I can guarantee to take care of him in one of our steamer chairs at Jones Beach." He accused Nathan Strauss, whose integrity was held in almost as much awe as Lehman's, of using his position as head of the state housing board to persuade a low-income housing development to purchase his own property for $200,000 more than it was worth. "If Senator Strauss made no claim to be anything more than a very slick trader, I should have a good deal more respect for him. When, however, he pretends to be a philanthropist, civic champion, and uplifter, it becomes a little disgusting," Moses said. Strauss's friends, who knew that the slick trader was so anxious to help provide decent houses for impoverished families that he had once sold a valuable property to the housing board for exactly 70 cents per square foot, felt a little disgust themselves. If he could not find anything about Lehman's associates to attack, he attacked them for alleged misdeeds of their fathers, even if the fathers were dead. "What is Jack Murray doing at the head of Governor Lehman's campaign committee if power connections are taboo in politics?" Moses demanded in one such charge. As the Herald Tribune pointed out, Mr. Moses does not explain his reference, but it was understood to infer that Mr. Murray's father, the late Thomas E. Murray, was connected with the Consolidated Edison Company. If there happened to be any truth in this onslaught of innuendo, Moses did not provide any convincing proof of it. Not one of his more serious charges was documented. Their subjects began treating them almost as jokes. When reporters asked Strauss for his reply, he would only say, "Bob Moses will be in the limelight for another 10 days and is entitled to all the fun he can get out of it. As one of his oldest friends, and the man who sponsored his entire park program in the state Senate, I wish him all the luck in the world." The one victim of Moses' attacks who did reply at length did so in telling fashion. The day after a particularly far-ranging Moses speech, Ed Flynn issued a statement saying, "The emotional instability of this candidate was never better demonstrated than last night, when, without rhyme or reason, he denounced in wholesale lots men who need no defense at my hands. If the campaign were to continue much longer, it would reach the point where this candidate would completely satisfy, at least himself, if no one else, that he is the only honest and efficient public servant that this state has ever known. Why does he not state publicly the opinion so often privately expressed by him of his Republican confreres that he now so affectionately takes to his bosom? Because he is now beholden to these members of the old guard for his nomination, he does not dare to publicly repeat his real opinion of them." Only one of Lehman's key supporters was spared the lash of Moses' tongue or pen. He was Alfred E. Smith. 30 years after the election, in the midst of a discussion about the former governor with a luncheon guest, a distinguished historian, Moses suddenly began talking about the day he asked Smith to support him against Lehman. The historian relates that Moses said, "I went to see the governor, and I said, 'Governor, you owe this to me. With your backing, I'm going to go ahead and win this thing. You owe it to me.' And you know what he said to me?